Bocelli, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassination, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Kelly!
Ah, here we are, summertime, ninth day of August, 2018, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and boy, is it hot in Georgia. Anyhow, this is indeed the O'Kelly Effect, broadcast live from the facilities of O'Kelly.com, also broadcast on a couple of other different networks and a variety of locations it's also available via your podcatcher du jour through a lot of different facilities out there. Some of them are working better than others, apparently. We'll hopefully straighten all that out in the coming weeks, but hard to keep track of all the different places you can get this show, so doing the best I can, folks. Anyway, it is a Thursday night, Thursday for most of you, and gotta tell you, this is the week that we have Carmine Savastano with us, and he is the author of Two Princes and a King. You might know this. Of course, he is the longest-standing co-host on this show, and gotta say, it's been an interesting trip. Why? Well, you know, one of the very first things that him and I discussed when we were first getting to know each other was the fact that we needed to do a series on the mythology connected to the JFK case. Tonight, we're going to continue that discussion. Now, again, it's summertime, so it was hard to try and book some other people to come on. We might be joined by Rob Clark at some point in the near future. Then again, who knows? Maybe he doesn't know what time it is, and maybe we miscommunicated. You never know. Again, it's summertime, so it is what it is. TPAAK.com, TPAAK.com is Carmine Savastano's website, and maybe I'll plug Rob's website if he shows up. Okay. So there is plenty to talk about when it comes to the mythology in the JFK case. Jeez, what episode number are we on? We've been doing this for a couple of years, Carmine.
Yeah, this is 14.
14.
So, same one that we'll be on for JFK 101 next episode.
Right, which is funny because that series only started, a year and a half ago?
Yeah.
And this, God, when did we start doing this? When was the first myth episode?
2015, I believe.
Oh, so like 3 years.
Yeah, in the spring of 2015 was the first one. You, me, Trish, and Zach.
And we're not out of material.
Nope. I don't know if we ever will be. It's created so quickly sometimes.
Well, isn't that the funny thing, right, is that no matter what we do, and I got to tell you that I thought about this a little bit before we did it. Have you been getting feedback on any of the myth stuff?
Oh, yeah. And largely all positive. As you know, the only real, and I really don't get any more of it, but early on, you know, there was some of the negative feedback from those that shall remain nameless who are featured in various episodes of the Myth Show.
Right, but you know what's funny to me is that every once in a while somebody discovers one of the old Myths episodes, and they bring their friends over to it, and they complain in a group, and then they go away. It's kind of funny. Let's see.
Yeah. Like a couple of years later, they'll go. I saw one where they actually got all vulgar and were upset and started like screaming to the heavens, and no one really paid any attention, so they went away.
Well, right, and that's the funny thing is like, you know, like 6-7 things. I mean, YouTube even starts marking it as spam. And every one of these episodes ends up on YouTube because we figure we should put them on a playlist somewhere. I mean, you're talking about 26 hours now of discussing.
It's a public
service. Yeah, and it's 26 hours. I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at as far as tackling all the different fallacies in the case. But they are unending, and some of them seem to come back much like a zombie apocalypse and resurrect themselves. Others have continued almost unabated despite my warnings and the warnings of others over the years. It's amazing. And
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, and I also want to, you know, and I know you do too, thank everyone that's ever appeared, because we've had, I would gather, probably over a dozen different people just from both sides of the case. I think myths are one of the few things that we can all find common ground on, that they're not helpful to anyone, no matter what side of the case they favor.
Well, and that's the thing, and a variety of individuals, too. I mean, like, even on the side that would be more your and my side, which is the concept that this is not according to the official story. Let's just boil it down.
Yeah, Alan,
go ahead.
Allendale, Larry Hancock, Rob Clark, Zach Gendro, Trish Fleming. We've also had, like, you know, you said people from the other side. We've had Glenn Viklund, Steve Rowe.
Sherry Feaster was on one of these.
Yep, Sherry Feaster, who I'd put on the side of conspiracy, but definitely an expert who at least is more in the middle. I'd say everyone that you had on was reasonable, too, which is important. And that, unfortunately, doesn't happen in every show. You know, sometimes you'll get fringe people from either side that don't want to have a conversation. They just want to try to verbally beat down the other person.
Well, right. And, I mean, I've even tried to have some of those fringe people on the show. You know that. You were there for some of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had to put up with it.
You know, which is another funny thing that happens every once in a while. You know, you see the YouTube comments on the, I guess it was the, I don't know, the 2016 JFK celebration of the anniversary. Or was it 2015? I forget which.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was 2015. Fetzer and Hanke.
Right. And Hanke turns out to be a lot more reasonable than Fetzer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and the bottom line is I understand. You know, I mean, I'm not going to – I understand the motivation for people to want to make something popular and want to make money. I just can't support it and, you know, am, like you, going to fight against anything that tries to manipulate history to make money.
Well, there you go. And now with that in mind, let's talk about a recent newsmaker, right? Or a couple of them really quickly. First of all, let's acknowledge Roger Stone as one of the guys who is, you know, in the mythmaker category when it comes to the Kennedy assassination. Absolutely refuses to look at anything other than Lyndon Johnson is responsible for it for some reason. I'm not sure why, but you know, knowing him, there's some agenda behind it. But then again, he's also an off-the-books advisor to a presidential candidate who, wait a minute, became president despite the fact that he was claiming that Ted Cruz's father was present with Lee Harvey Oswald and is therefore connected to the JFK assassination. I mean, hello. You know, weird stuff there. But we've tackled all that. One of the guys, though, that's been a conduit for all of these people at one time or another, although I can't say that he's had Judy Baker on his show. Oops, I said it.
He has had Fetzer, though.
He has had James Fetzer. He's had other people that have supported Judy on his show and other crazy individuals that want to tell you that, you know, there's reason to believe that the alien agenda is actually behind Kennedy's assassination, and that, you know, there were I don't know, 30 shooters are we up to now, 32, I'm not sure, you know, how many shooters there were, and yeah, we can name them, even though three of these names at the top of the list have already been debunked. And I'm pretty sure he even did some James Files stuff. Other people have been featured quite prominently in our myth series, and that would be Alex Jones over there, who, you know, is screaming about his martyrdom, and please make sure to buy all of his crap so that you can continue to support his multi-million dollar operation that has been so unfairly treated in recent weeks by getting banned from various platforms, although Twitter won't ban him. And these different corporate entities have made decisions based on his violation of their community policies, not based on the fact that anybody's attempting to silence him selectively or anything like that. But truth be told, a lot of the things that this man has said over the years would have gotten somebody like me, well, at least a visit from the Secret Service, if not various components of the Department of Homeland Security. But meanwhile, let's not focus on all that madness exactly. He has been one of the worst purveyors of nonsense when it comes to the Kennedy assassination. During the opening of the Obama deception, his big hit film where, you know, the Obama Antichrist figure was here to destroy America, which apparently never came to fruition, I guess because Alex was fighting him. You know, even during the opening sequence of that film, JFK was killed because he was issuing silver certificates, and that mythology, the old and tried and true patriot mythology, if you will, or John Bircher mythology, if you will. I don't know what to call it, but the whole concept of the executive order got him killed because he was fighting the international bankers and so on. I mean, what do you got to say about Alex Jones, though? Because you're not somebody who's been highly focused on this kind of media as much as I have been over the past way too long to talk about. But really, since it's been there, I've been interested in the alternative media, so to speak. And even before there was an internet and I was listening to it on shortwave radio and mailing in and becoming parts of little groups that got special mailings of, you know, tape recordings and documents and all of that. I mean, I was part of that stuff a long time ago, and now I'm doing it for myself. But what are your viewpoints on Alex Jones?
Well, I definitely agree with you that he's a myth maker. I first came across him years ago. I don't know if you remember a conversation you and I had off air once was, I think that this is common for a lot of people who get involved in the JFK case, is often you have to spend probably a year unlearning all the bad information that you picked up along the way online.
Mm-hmm.
And in that first year, like in any, you know, in the study of any topic, when you are brand new to it, when you don't have the skepticism built up of having been lied to or having read something that was proclaimed to be the truth that when you check it against evidence turns out to be ridiculous, are more likely to believe things. And some people never actually move on from that point. They just believe whatever's told to them. And that's, hey, you know, everybody's got their method of inquiry. That's not mine.
Well, see, hold on, Carmine, because you're going through this whole logical process. And yeah. I got to tell you, the majority of people I encounter on this case that have even a vague interest in it don't even go this far. I mean, you're making it way too complex. Honestly, a lot of them, they used to read books, now they don't, but they go on YouTube, they find a couple of documentaries that sort of comport with their own political or worldview in one way or another, and they go, that's the answer. And it doesn't matter if Jackie Kennedy is suddenly a Black Widow spider in disguise and Kennedy was actually a reptilian and it was good that he was wiped out, or, you know, there was a confetti camera, a cannon, and the corpses were switched and various things happened and it was all done basically to keep the alien cover-up going. It's irrelevant. They just find something on the fringe and go, have you seen this? One guy who works in alternative media really got upset with me when I just completely slammed his whole, well, Oswald wasn't really killed, neither was Kennedy. It seems like it was just performance art. And look, there's no blood on the floor when Oswald is shot by Ruby. And I went, you know, a little bit nuts on him, and I was kind of mean. And he's like, well, I don't understand why you would do that. How could you say that? And I'm like, because when you spend a long time looking at actual evidence and investigating even the fringe stuff to some degree, stuff that you wouldn't even touch, I've been through, you know this, it's very frustrating to see people try to introduce new nonsense into the equation. And we'd like to prevent that. I mean, we can't erase, unfortunately, the past 20 years of people using this as an opportunity to purvey their fan fiction upon all of us and to put out these ideas about lost romances and secret super agents that were actually just this 24-year-old kid who was actually five different people, and there were, you know, various duplicates of him running around, and you know, he was like James Bond, had been run through a Xerox machine. Here we go. And it's like, you just want to make people stop and look and say, look, this is important for some very realistic reasons. We should look at this reasonably. And it's hard to do in the new normal where, again, people are not reading as much. People are not taking some very serious work that others have done. And utilizing it to take it further or correcting some of the mistaken ideas of the past and trying to improve upon them. They're literally just seizing upon something that's got a little bit of juice to it, that's got a little bit of something that is entertaining about it, and comports with the wildest theory they can come up with. So those that often claim that there's a great deal of victory in the fact that, well, most people don't believe it was, you know, the government's story and we're winning. We're not really winning if we get them to think the Easter Bunny did it with the candlestick in the library, okay? It's just, it's not good enough to go there and claim victory because, well, at least they don't believe the Warren Commission. You know what I'm saying? You are going through this as a reasonable person, but you got to admit that we often encounter people who just, like I said, latch on to this one outlier concept. And Alex Jones is good for huckstering that stuff. He always has been. And the fact is that, you know, some real information is mixed in with his garbage. So, you know, some people say, look, he's right about this and he's right about that. And it's like, yeah, but pick anybody that you want that's a disinformation artist, and you can find that they're not lying to you 100% of the time. Okay.
Well, yeah, and just because there are a few positive things doesn't mean the overall thing is worthwhile. If there are so many bad things that it totally outweighs whatever positives can be garnered from it.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, us agreeing with James Fetzer that, listen, it certainly appears to have been a conspiracy. Yeah, okay, positive side doesn't mean we're on the same team. Okay,
no.
You know, is Oswald innocent? Well, that's a questionable thing. Exactly what you mean by innocent. Is he the guy that probably pulled this off? It appears no. But
not alone, at the very least.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. You want to go lone assassin.
Oh, well, that's the simplest. Yeah, actually, when we get into guilt and innocence later, the other topic I want to discuss, because I later on will contend, and I think this is can be demonstrated with evidence, that it is neither true that he is absolutely guilty or absolutely innocent, as some people would contend and have for years.
Right, you know, and we actually spent time in an episode of Myths going through that as well. Again, this will be, you know.
And it was actually the three of us. So this, I actually got some new information from some legal precedents. So.
Well, cool. And you know what? Look, we're going to do another one of these before the end of the year. And when we do, we're going to bring the rapid fire kind of, here's a myth, let's destroy it, you know, mechanism back into play. And I want to gather those things up, let people have their fun for the summer. It's hard to get people to come on a talk show during the summer sometimes, to be honest with you, unless they're really out there promoting something or they're your really good friend. It's very difficult sometimes to get people to settle down, come inside, relax, and do a podcast with you or do a radio show. So, you know, just saying. So anyway, with all that in mind, go ahead back to your process, though, because you have this reasonable mechanism. It might be a little conservative for my taste or for some other listener's taste, but it's not craziness, and it's not, gee, I saw three YouTube videos, now I think I'm an expert. Like, I used to laugh when somebody said, oh, I read everything on the case, and I go, really? How many books is that? And they have a number that's, you know, three or five or six, and I go, okay, well, first of all, you haven't come close to reading everything. Secondly, you've read books, which are a representation of somebody else's research, and you know what? In some cases, they provide you with some very good information, and they are worthwhile. But realistically, how do you know that the information in said author's book is anything other than nonsense? You know, and but today it's just, I saw a YouTube video, so therefore, you know, Jackie Kennedy shot him, actually, and she's a spider, and he was a reptile, and, you know, the Mandela effect said that Governor Connolly was never in the car. So, I mean, literally, that's the line of logic I'm getting, which, by the way, have you seen that whole thing?
That people are trying to use the Mandela effect now?
Yeah, that they're saying
explain
that,
things.
Yeah, that there was never other people in the car. There was only Kennedy and Jackie and the driver.
Unfortunately,
you know,
the photography, all of it, would dispute that.
Well, see, in the new reality, then therefore, you know, it would be changed in the new reality, but our memories would still retain the. I can't even finish the thought. Carmine,
yeah.
It's just, that's what it is, though. Connolly was never in the car, and it's like, well, that's interesting, because in the reality I was in, we were always trying to fit Connolly's wounds into the equation.
Well, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, and that's why it's very important, as you were saying, to have evidentiary standards, because you can take ideas like that and just throw them out the window. There are some things that are not worth our time to investigate. As you know, I won't use any of the fringe things I don't think are reliable, but I will investigate them from time to time if they start to gain traction, as such as, you know, some of the many topics we've covered on this show.
Right.
But other than that, yeah, there's no reason to even bother with them, because you can largely see that they're nonsense just by getting involved in the first few pages. I mean, sooner or later, they're going to drop the bomb where it's just a total speculation that has nothing to do with the facts. And, you know, pretty much at that point, okay, it's just a theory. It really has no weight to it.
Right. And you know what? It's the contortion that somebody desires to do intellectually, too, because when it comes to James Files, right, people have resurrected that with me and come at me again with it about James Files. You know, he admitted to killing Kennedy. Yeah, that's true. He did confess, but his confession is questionable, because he's got most of the facts wrong. Well, you know, they for years people said, why are they still keeping him in prison then? Because he's got something to say. That's why nobody's talking to him, and only Jim Mars interviewed him, and only this one guy has the interview. And I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. But then he got released. And now the justification is, look, they released him because he had the goods on him. That's why we haven't heard from him. Maybe it's because his story, once, you know, people decided to see if it lined up with the evidence at all, doesn't work.
and has changed, just like every myth does.
Oh, various times. And if you get your hands on the outtakes of those interviews, every name, just like a compulsive liar. Hey, did you know Fletcher Prouty? Well, sure I did. I served with him, you know.
and they can't produce, you know, I mean, it's, you know, just another classic example of why we can. And it's not just restricted, as, you know, we've gone over and I'll go over later. You know, it's not just restricted to the public. The officials are the kings of using deception and myth in some cases. It's just, unfortunately, the public has seemed to try to mimic them. It's almost as if some people in the public think that if they craft a better lie than already exists, and it's compelling enough to convince the public, that's a good thing, instead of actually rendering the evidence so that we know the actual answer.
Right, and I also feel it absolutely obligatory to remind those that are Trump supporters that many of you told me specifically that I should be very happy that he's president, because he's going to make sure that all of the documentation related to the assassination will be released, because he wants to make sure to embarrass the deep state over Kennedy's assassination. Well, that didn't happen in 2017. They kicked the can down the road. Trump immediately acquiesced to the intelligence agencies. And now we have a serious uncertainty as to whether or if there is a possibility of the release of tens of thousands of documents now. Just saying. Oh, and by the way, those of you who believe in the QAnon thing, this interesting story that JFK Jr. might have staged his own death so he could become the leader of QAnon. Have you heard that story, Cormac?
No, and I wish I hadn't.
Yeah, well, I figured, listen, since Rob Clark's not here, let me bring the most outlandish thing I could find. Yeah, John F. Kennedy Jr. apparently staged his own death so that he could indeed become part of the team that would fight the deep state, and he is actually Q, in hiding.
Chuck,
yes.
I just wanted to say on Skype, I'll let you know, Rob did just get here.
Oh, okay, great. We'll add Rob Clark into the discussion, but let's see how this goes. However, did you hear that story? You didn't hear that story. Now you wish you hadn't. But do you have any thoughts on JFK Jr. being the infamous Q, or do you have anything you'd like to say about QAnon at all?
Well, I've already blocked a couple of QAnon people from the Neapolis Media Group Twitter. It's been a while since I've had to block anybody.
Nice.
Because they didn't like that I posted that it emerged from Jones, which is a purveyor of I think it's just, I don't, you know, timing, they say, I guess, but that was 2 or 3 weeks ago. And then as soon as I put that out, some of the QAnon people got mad at me and started basically just trying to troll the accounts. I blocked them, and I haven't, you know, really had to deal with them anymore. But okay, guys, number one, not only in QAnon, but in every consideration of everything that could be a conspiracy.
Right.
If the source is anonymous, it's not to be trusted. It's not proven. Sorry.
Well, no, but
you can't prove it, then you're just spouting.
Okay, two points of defense, Carmine, I'm going to offer. Because okay. You know me, I always got to play the contrarian. Yeah. Two points of defense. First of all, the information is not trustworthy in and of itself. However, if you find it worthy of follow-up, an anonymous source providing information could be the thing that leads you to some evidence, not evidence in and of itself.
It also could be the thing that wastes your time and causes problems for no reason.
Well, this is true, but journalists utilize anonymous sources all the time in order to build stories, and when they do it with some ethics behind it, it works out pretty well.
Unfortunately, there's lots of I just see anonymous sources, no matter who uses them. I don't think journalistic reports that use just anonymous sources are as trustworthy as ones that have named sources, because then the person is subject to what they said.
Well,
anyone can say anything anonymously.
Listen, that's true. But one more thing, believe it or not, this phrase is going to come out of my mouth. In defense of Alex Jones, he is not the guy who originated QAnon. I mean, this thing originated from a 4chan discussion board.
Yeah, which I think is another reason why it can't be believed, is because it emerged from a rumor mill for entertainment. That's what they do. They're famous for starting controversies online out of nothing for their entertainment.
But Carmine, if I were JFK Jr. and I wanted to launch a covert plan many years after faking my own death to lead QAnon, I would certainly go to 4chan, wouldn't you?
No, of course not. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Okay.
It's like, why wouldn't you go to some sort of an outlet with some reliability if you really wanted to make a difference? And that's why I know this is all ridiculous. The only people that are benefiting from this QAnon ridiculousness are the people selling the t-shirts. Those are the only people benefiting from it.
Well,
and the people laughing.
And Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, but honestly, I don't think it's going to ultimately really benefit him. I think it's going to hurt him.
You know what? I understand, but I'm not so sure. With all that in mind, we got the lone gunman with us. And
hey, Rob.
Right on time, in the middle of the QAnon discussion, Rob Clark, the host of the Lone Gunman podcast. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing much better now. What's happening, fellas?
Oh, you got to back off your mic just a touch because you're overdriving quite a bit. But okay. Anyway. It's good to hear from Rob. I have not talked to Rob in a while. I know you heard.
I'm still alive.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad you are. What's happening with the Lone Gunman, my friend, before we get into the mythology a bit deeper? What's going on?
I'm just on hiatus right now. Is that what they call it, a hiatus?
Well, sabbatical, yeah. Yeah. You're out there touring the world on kung fu walks until you've decided to return.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm always watching, just interacting less.
Okay.
Well, I understand.
I'm being asked in the chat room to explain QAnon. All right. I will. Very briefly, this is how I would explain it. It is an organization of individuals that many are taking in certain media circles to be whistleblowers of a secretive and anonymous nature. They are calling themselves Q or QAnon, and they have quite a following among the very same people that are Trump supporters, but I do believe they pre-existed Trump supporters. They claim to have inside information from intelligence agencies and within the deep state, because they were indeed insiders at one time or are currently insiders. They are alleged to be either one individual at the head or a small group of individuals that are claiming anonymity and allegedly revealing truth to the world. However, I find them to be a joke, personally. And just yet another one of these interesting psyops that, if it is useful to somebody, you might want to consider who actually benefits. Anyways, there you go. You just enter QAnon into a search engine. You'll find out more, but hopefully you don't get sucked into stupid. All right. Go ahead.
I just wanted to finish up and offer that the one thing I did see about them that I read in the news recently is that Anonymous is now going after them. because personally, I don't know. I don't know the motivations of either for, in a definitive nature. But I bet you Anonymous doesn't want other groups like it around. And that's what QAnon is. It's sort of a right-wing Anonymous.
Well, see, Anonymous is a funny thing. That is a label that you see tossed around a lot. But real people that were part of that, that were, part of the hacking deep web underground, there's really a couple of different factions there.
Okay, and, so a faction of Anonymous is going after them.
Oh, yeah, because there's a faction of individuals claiming to be Anonymous as well that are fully in support of QAnon, which is also kind of funny. But then again, a whole lot of those guys who are really high-skilled hackers have been co-opted and hired by the governments now in order to defend against people like themselves. So, I mean, it's a very strange world you get into when you get into the deep politics of the deep web, if you will. And Anonymous, QAnon, all this stuff is all part and parcel of the shadow, smoke, and mirrors of the digital age we're in. And that's the way I see it. Anyway, the legitimate people in Anonymous that I have encountered that I do believe are absolutely legitimate, I would love to see them dismember QAnon because they're capable of it. But anyway, we'll leave it there because I don't want to get into a whole discussion on this.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're not doing a myths episode. And we got Rob with us, which is a rarity. So definitely go ahead and continue, Carmine. But I'm anxious to get to talking to more with Rob, considering he's on hiatus. And it's so much fun to have you here, man. Thank you for joining us, by the way.
Yeah, no problem. I'm just glad to finally get here. I was aware of this enormous Skype update that happened, and that's why I'm late, but I'm here.
Oh, yeah, I totally understand, man. I had it when I did an update once, it erased all of my contacts.
Nice.
So it's like luckily I had
totally
saved
new.
Before. Yeah. Okay, but I'll just finish up the Alex Jones thing, and then if you want, we can have Rob do the first myth, and then we can jump into the other ones that I did and whatever you want to talk about, Chuck.
Absolutely.
With Alex Jones, I only find one problem, and that was the manner and the reasoning why it was done. Yes, these are private companies. They have the right, as unfortunately we all experienced when they came after Chuck's YouTube channel, to take you down if someone complains or if someone says it's unfair. But they also have the responsibility to check. And luckily they did in Chuck's case after an appeal, and they brought it back. With Jones, he's done it so many times, he's violated their standards so often and with such flagrancy that, of course, they were just looking for an excuse to eventually act against him, like anyone who keeps violating their standards. But because they used hate speech as the reasoning, that's what I disagree with. No, hate speech, as I've said before, and I'm sure lots of people disagree with me and some might agree with me, is, in my opinion, ridiculous. Words can be hateful, sentiments can be hateful, but it doesn't have to be one of these specific magic words that people don't like to be hate speech. And you know what? Life doesn't guarantee that you don't have to ever be hated by anyone.
See, but then again,
that's just life.
But then again, okay, listen, Ocelli.com is my platform, right? If I deem something to be hate speech, whether I'm sane about it or not, that's my business. So quite honestly, if they deemed it as whatever, it's fine. There's no objection. And truthfully, this has been nothing more than a martyrdom as an advertising campaign for him. He's actually doing better. His apps are not, gone from their stores and all that. Google's still carrying his apps. Apple's still carrying his apps. He's getting more downloads than he ever did. Lots of traffic, lots of attention.
Yeah.
And after his multiple claims over the years that they're going to come and silence him, he now has something to wave around to say, look, see, I was telling you all along that the big people were going to try and stop me. The globalists were coming. And there they are. So, real honestly, this plays into his whole paradigm, number one. Number two, one other thing here that I keep having to note is if I had made these threatening statements against government officials, I promise you my door would have been kicked in. I promise you that. Okay.
Yeah, well, see, but that's the issue. I think the hate speech is ridiculous, and they shouldn't have used it because it's not a valid reason, and it gives him the ability to fight and say he's being censored. What they should have done was use the legal reasons. Like every time he said he was going to kill someone that he didn't like, every time that he did something that was illegal, like slander against the parents and the children in Sandy Hook, that's a reason that's legitimate to get rid of him because the companies can then be sued. That makes sense. in a dollars and cents way. Hate speech is ridiculous. Well, it's too subjective.
He literally said that Robert Mueller was present during child rape. I mean,
yeah, that is something you can hammer him on legitimately. Yeah.
I mean, you know, come on. If I made statements like that, I promise you again that I would have been either sued or taken down. This guy is controlled opposition, full stop. And he is there for the purposes of being a martyr every now and then, being taken down every now and then. But he's got plenty of privileges that he's played out over the years. And like I said, people have been taken down for saying much less. People have been visited by government agencies for saying much less than this guy did. So quite honestly, it is what it is. And you can do business with who you want. That's why, you know, like the whole thing with the people that don't want to make cakes for gay couples. Listen, that's their business if they don't want to do business with people. I know it's a slippery slope and, you know, it gets into a weird area, but either you can choose to who you do business with or not. You can throw people out of restaurants if you feel like it too, because it's your opportunity to do business with somebody or not. And if Google chose not to do business with me because I had violated some terms because I contracted with them, then it would have been just fine if they removed me because I violated some term between, us as entities. But that's not what happened to me. This is what happened to Alex Jones. He violated their terms. And that's it. He's no martyr. So anyway, I leave it at that, and I would like to get into what Rob has in mind, because, man, Rob, you are the king of bringing the weirdest thing. I mean, I had to try and preempt you a little bit by bringing up the whole JFK Jr. faked his death in order to become the head of QAnon. I had to bring that in because it was the closest thing I could think of that might be able to compete with the weird stuff that you, my friend, bring to the table when it comes to myths. So I'm sure you're going to blow me out of the water tonight, but I put it out there anyway. Rob, first of all, have you heard about JFK Jr. faking his death to be the QAnon leader?
I actually have. I saw that. There's some guy out there that does a podcast. He does YouTube videos, and I stumbled upon one where he was talking about that and noting the similarities, you know, of what he said when he was alive and what's being said now and what he said he was going to do. And what's being done now, and there's a whole podcast dedicated to it. I mean, it's crazy. But that is definitely a good one, Chuck.
There are multiple podcasters. It's a good one. Yeah. There are multiple podcasters doing this, but you found one on YouTube. I didn't even see the one on YouTube. I saw it in a feed. I have a couple of podcast feeds where I take a look at what some other people are doing just to know what to avoid, to be honest with you. I've actually got like a couple of those little podcatchers set up, and I purposely pick up the worst stuff that I can. just to go, okay, what is ridiculous and popular among people that are not thinking? I really do have two podcatchers set up just to do that. I check them about once a week.
Yeah. It's like a good car wreck, you know. You can't help but watch or listen, you know, sometimes. It's entertainment.
Right.
Right. You just can't believe what some of these people are saying and what they're thinking and why people are even listening. But, you know, we've been thinking the same thing for years. And, you know, when Carmine told me we're going to do another Miss episode, I just happened to have been contacted by a fellow through my podcast website email. And he's an author, just wrote a book. And it's called Motive and Opportunity, H.L. Hunt, The Means by Which H.L. Hunt Influenced the Assassination of JFK, King, Bobby, and Hoffa.
Hang on, Rob. Because, okay. Motive and Opportunity. Carmine, yes. let me ask you your impression of just that title before we get into H.L. Hunt and wherever this goes, connecting it to Bobby and King as well, Rob?
Yeah, and Hoffa.
Okay. Before we get into that nexus, you take a look at a book that's titled Motive and Opportunity, and you think to yourself, well, gee, the only thing that's missing from that is the means, right, Carmine?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. There's something missing from that title.
Yeah, but yeah. It almost sounds serious enough that maybe you go, well, let me take a look. I mean, it's not, hey, I'm going to tell you how the people that worked in the freak show in Massachusetts actually plotted the murder of Kennedy or something. This is, you know, or the guy who said he was a rodeo rider that was part of a car theft ring that killed, you know who I'm talking about, don't you, Rob?
Yeah.
It's not one of those. You go, oh, okay, motive and opportunity. And there was a time period here where certain people died and people disappeared and a lot of death going on. Maybe it is all connected, and you almost want to take it seriously. Well, anyway, I'll let Rob continue, and we'll find out why not to. Go ahead.
When the guy contacted me, I was like, all right, look, you send me a copy of your book, and I'll read it, and you know, I'll let you know what I think about it, and you know, if I decide to have you on the show to further explore what you've written about here, you know, that's a viable possibility as well. But I wanted to read the book first because, you know, sometimes when you get to be as skeptical as we are about
because
things,
Richard Charnin's an author.
Yeah. You know, and I personally had never heard of this guy before. The author's name is Mitchell.
Because David Von Pine has also released a book, and Roger Stone, we already mentioned. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Rob. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, this guy's Mitchell Whitington is the author. And it's one of those, this is my story. I was there. I lived it. John Currington as told to Michael Whitington. Okay, so the story is basically one of those, you know, hey, I was there, this is what happened type deals, and Mitchell is just relaying to us what John Currington told this guy. And you know, you mentioned, okay, the title is just motive and opportunity. And this guy certainly had the means as well. At one time, he was the richest man in the world. I mean, we're talking about H.L. Hunt here. He's worth, in today's money, $2 billion.
Okay. Well, one second, Rob. I'm a little confused because what you're telling me is the author is telling us a story that he was told by a particular individual. And that individual, claims to have been involved directly with key actors and players in the story. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure I got this straight.
For many, many years, a fellow by the name of John Currington. He did work for H.L. Hunt. This can be. There's plenty of things of proof in here with letters from H.L. Hunt about this guy. He definitely did work for H.L. Hunt for a period of probably 20 to 30 years. You know, he was under his employ for quite a while. Much like, you know, the story you've heard of, I forget what his other employee's name was, the guy that he supposedly sent to buy a copy of the Zapruder film. I don't know if you've heard that about H.L. Hunt sent somebody to buy a copy of the Zapruder film.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that. And another thing that strikes me here right away is that, you know, Barr McClellan was indeed a lawyer and certainly worked for a significant law firm. You know, that was connected to Lyndon Johnson. Now, you go beyond that claim, who knows where we're going, but Barr McClellan, it almost sounds like a Barr McClellan-esque story here.
Right, that, you know, and that's what I'm thinking. You know, so I started reading this book. I try to dispel my doubts. You know, I just don't want to throw the book against the wall, but so I figured I'd give it a chance. So, you know, I'm reading through here and, you know, I'm kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting because it tells you a lot about H.L. Hunt's life and, you know, all the money that he made and stuff that he did. And then it, of course, has Mr. Currington's story, you know, what all he did for H.L. Hunt and what kind of man he was and the kind of business that he did, you know. So I'm thinking, okay, well, let me keep on flipping here and get to the juicy bits, you know, about JFK and MLK and Bobby and Hoffa and all this, so I can see what the hell this guy's trying to say here. Because if you listen carefully to the subtitle, it's the means by which H.L. Hunt influenced the assassination of JFK, King, Bobby, and Hoffa, which it is entirely possible. At the time, H.L. Hunt, you know, he's one of the richest men in the world. In the early 60s, he starts a radio show called, I think it was called Lifeline. Or something to this effect. And he was basically, you know, very right-wing, hate speech, if you will, like true hate speech, not fake hate speech, but, you know, he was getting on the air. He would buy time at all these radio stations. I mean, he would pay like $6,000, you know, I think it was a week to get on these radio stations. And to do his show, it was like a 15-minute show every day that he did. But it was just very right-wing, extreme right-wing kind of stuff, you know. And he would say things about JFK, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, Jimmy Hoffa. The reason he didn't like Jimmy Hoffa is because, you know, Hoffa was trying to unionize a bunch of his unions would have affected H.L. Hunt's employees. I mean, he was a big employer. He employed thousands and thousands of people nationwide, you know, in all these different industries. And for Hoffa to try to unionize a lot of his industries, he was very against it. You know what I'm saying? And of course, he had his reasons why he wasn't a fan of JFK and Bobby and Martin Luther King. And you know, he shared these same views as a lot of people did back then. Guys like General Walker, you know, he tells a story that General Walker and H.L. Hunt were friends. They used to visit each other. They would often talk and trade stories, you know, and dispense the same kind of information and hate speech and things of this nature. And what, you know, it doesn't say, the book doesn't really come out and say, hey, you know, H.L. Hunt paid for the assassination to take place like I thought it was going to. And in fact, in this book, it dispels one of our biggest myths that we've covered on the show.
Okay, well, let's just recap really quickly. What you're telling me is there's some decent information in here kind of laying out the influence that H.L. Hunt was attempting to have. And, of course, he was a big oil man, certainly a rich man for his time. Like you said, he'd be a billionaire today, so he would certainly be a player. He'd probably have a lot more effective means than buying 15 minutes worth of radio time across a bunch of stations. Nowadays,
right.
He would have a lot of things at his disposal. I mean, he could potentially be like a really
Alex
angry
Jones.
Koch brother
yeah.
kind of guy, and supporting somebody like Alex Jones, indeed, to say, hey, listen, just give me 15 minutes worth of your broadcast per day. Because, you know, there used to be a figure named Phyllis Schlafly who was out there doing this, right? Which, by the way, go ahead and Google that if you want. Listeners, because you'll find an interesting lineage connected to Phyllis Schlafly, who died, I think, a couple of years ago, and her offspring and the influence they've had over media over several years. But she was like the woman's voice of conservatism, if you will. H.L. Hunt did a less tame version of that. And today, like I said, he would be highly influential in a lot of media circles, probably. Who knows? Maybe he could even be Rupert Murdoch, right? You know, but what's fascinating is, okay, so he definitely played the game as far as being on the side of wanting to quash the progressive concepts in this country. Certainly was on the right-wing side of the equation. Definitely yes. Didn't seem to be all that kind to poor people and didn't want to see unions come into play. So he was one of these guys, and that kind of thing is laid out pretty well in this book, you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't very fond of, you know, minorities or civil rights or things like that.
Yeah, okay. So, in other words, a fair portrayal of stuff that was going on in H.L. Hunt's stratosphere, his universal orbits, if you will, as far as his influence. I mean, it's kind of laid out nicely here. But
yeah.
Here's the fun part. You're going to tell us that it absolutely dispels one of the myths that's very popular that we've had to cover on this show. Oh, and I'm going to have to remind myself to ask you about the LBJ connection to the book, but go ahead and tell us about this, because I'm anxious to hear what myth got dispelled in this book.
Well, I will tell you. It's one of our most popular myths that a lot of people love to throw up in your face and say, well, this happened, and this person was there, and that person was there, and, you know, it definitely happened. Well, there was a woman who claimed to be LBJ's girlfriend and part of a very elite group. I believe he doesn't mention her name, but I believe we all know who that is, Madeline Duncan Brown.
Right.
It says she said in both print interviews and on television shows that the night before the assassination of John Kennedy, she was attending a party with Johnson at the Dallas home of oil man Clint Murchison. According to her, the guest list was a regular who's who of the day, including Murchison, Hoover, Assistant FBI Director Clyde Tolson, a banker and Washington player John J. McCloy, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, George Brown, Jack Ruby, H.L. Hunt, Hunt's right-hand man, yours truly, John Carrington. So she even said this guy was there, and says, I've seen the guest list vary depending on who's relating the account, but those are the major players that seem to usually be named. And the alleged lady friend of LBJ contends that once all the players had arrived, the men retired behind closed doors for a meeting. And according to her account, when the meeting was over, LBJ came up to her and said, after tomorrow, those goddamn Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. We've all heard the story.
Right.
The only problem with her story is that the meeting never happened. I never went to such a gathering. I can also say with a high degree of certainty that Mr. Hunt did not attend either. If he had gone to Clint Murchison's house, there's simply no question that he would have asked me to drive over with him. Not only did I accompany him almost everywhere, but I knew almost every minute of his daily schedule. More than that, however, there are people on the guest list that would have never been in the same room with each other. Jack Ruby is probably the most obvious. He was a wannabe gangster at best, so even if he was going to be used as part of some plot or conspiracy, he would never have been asked to be part of the planning stage with some of the most powerful men in the world. So yeah. There you go. He basically says, it's a wonderful story, but it didn't happen.
Well, and I'd nice. Add to that, it lines up with so many of the other, you know, problems that we've heard over the years, like Charles Cliff brought to one of the Old Myths episodes that Murchison actually didn't own the house that she claimed it happened in at the time, and she said it happened. And right. Then we have the fact that LBJ and Kennedy were seen in town getting ready for the events of the next day. They weren't at LBJ wasn't at some meeting way the hell out of Murchison's house. Some right. So my thing too is like, why even have a secret meeting if you're going to have so many people? It's not very secret, is it? If you need 20 people at a meeting, you've pretty much blown the conspiracy. There's no reason to have it anymore.
Well, see, and also, why are you inviting your girlfriend? You know, because right. Why is Madeline Brown there in the first place? Okay.
Yeah.
Which, again, alleged girlfriend, fine. I'm satisfied that she had some sort of relationship with Johnson at some point.
That's
I don't
it,
know. You know, and well, no, and I mean, he may have indeed been the father of her son. I even will go that far.
Do you know who pushed that, though, for quite some time, just to bring it all back around?
Tell me.
Alex Jones.
Well, of course he did.
Right.
You know, but then again, so did some of the venerated figures of past JFK, you know, the spirit of JFK assassinations past, you know.
Oh, I know.
Jim Mars.
And I don't make any excuses for any of them either.
No, I'm not making an excuse.
Yeah, it was a mistake.
And
no, you said venerated. So I just think those who make excuses for them are doing a disservice to them.
Right, right.
They made mistakes. And some people want, well, in Fetzer's case, I'm sorry, but it's no longer a mistake. When you're committed so vehemently to being wrong and you will just trash anybody and not even give a thought to evidence, you're the problem. You're no longer, you're just as bad as officials.
Well, no,
but he had over 100 conversations with Madeline Brown.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
But Jim Mars did some good in the assassination community, unlike Jim Fetzer. But,
oh, yeah, well, yeah. No, I'm not saying that they're essentially the exact same thing, but I'm saying that, unfortunately, Mars bought into JVB.
Yes, he
did. Mars never made a conspiracy he didn't like.
See, now that's the problem with Mars. You're right. But here's what's interesting is yet again, we have another person who's, you know, alleged to have been there who couldn't have been because he says he wasn't. First of all, well, gee, Chuck, you don't think the guy would lie to cover it up? Maybe. But it's interesting that he's willing to reveal all these other intimate details, and he's part of a book that kind of lays out the idea that Hunt would have been somebody who influenced the assassination. And yet, see, this story would actually be helpful to the guy writing this book if it was true, right? The assassination party's true. I've got one of the people on the guest list. It would have been helpful to him. But over the years, yeah, the assassination party is one of those things that just it does not hold water. It just doesn't. Hoover being cited in Washington way too early to have gotten back from Dallas when he did, if he had been there. How is it LBJ slipped everybody's notice? I mean, it's not like he was easy to miss in a crowd. LBJ was kind of a big guy who made his presence known everywhere he went. Why do you have your girlfriend there? Why is there a party anyway where you're plotting things in what? Oh, a separate conference room, allegedly, right? No, no, and no. But it's interesting that a book like this sort of looks like it's going to be, oh, wow, we're going to go through the incredible the oil men killed him story. Right. And meanwhile, we don't get that. We actually get something that's a whole lot more reasonable, Rob, it sounds like to me.
Yeah, I mean, the basic crust of – or crux, sorry, not the crust, but the basic crux of the book centers around the fact that maybe Mr. Hunt didn't have any direct influence as far as he didn't have any planning or payments or anything of that nature towards the assassination, but that Hunt always thought that the things that he said – you know, on the public airwaves could have possibly influenced people like Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, you know, James Earl Ray, these, you know, the basically what he was saying on the radio is what he was worried about, you know, things happening in real life that he could be possibly blamed for or saying, well, you know, if you hadn't have said what you said about JFK and how he was this and how he was that, you know, you're making the people that listen to you, you know, act out on what you're saying. And it says in the book, you know, he was generally scared that he had influenced, you know, some of these people to like take up a gun and murder, these famous leaders because of the things that he was saying.
Well, I gotta be honest. I mean, let's examine that particular idea objectively really quickly. Carmine, if you had been on air saying a lot of very hateful things, about somebody in particular, and I don't think we've ever actually done that on this show, but if we were being hateful and really like, oh, gee, you know, I wish this person would disappear from the planet and how awful of a human being they are and they're devoid of value and, gee, if somebody ran them over with a car, it would be all right. If we were saying that about somebody and a matter of fact, a group of somebodies who happened to be on a particular side of an equation that we didn't like and then they start in short order turning up dead after we've spent time and money making sure to get that message out there, first of all, I might feel a little like, oh, maybe I'm guilty of inspiring somebody's ideas. I can actually see that. I mean, couldn't you see that, Carmine?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, totally possible. If you've got somebody who is mentally unstable or weak-minded, even an unintentional, you know, even if you offhandedly said something, yeah, sure, they could want to go act on it. I don't know whether or not, because I know we're just over the hour, we can do it right when we come back, or if you want to go a little bit long, because I have a live update for this. I actually found something in Weisberg's archives while we've been talking that has to do with this guy, and apparently he's backwalking the story and adding a few things now, because there's an older version of this story that he presented to the Inquirer.
You know what? Let's go over the hour break. But Rob, this is great. I like that you presented this one. Is there anything you'd like to add before Carmine gives us a little live update to the story?
I just wanted to address real quick the Dear Mr. Hunt letter from Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well, explain what it is first. Explain it first. Remember, not everybody knows what that is, but go ahead.
Okay. There was a Dear Mr. Hunt letter that surfaced sometime after the assassination that was dated November 8th, 1963. And it says, Dear Mr. Hunt, I would like information concerning my position. I am asking only for information. I am suggesting that we discuss the matter fully before any steps are taken by me or anyone else. Thank you, Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay.
Okay. Now, over the years, that has been presented as, by certain people, a letter to not H.L. Hunt, but to E. Howard Hunt. Right?
That's right.
Because they would say that this is Oswald reaching out to a CIA-based colleague about his position and being very vague in his language to try and establish a – first of all, why would you do that with a letter if you're two CIA guys? But anyway, that's what that's been alleged to be.
Rather than your name.
Yeah, that's another thing, too. But that's what that's been alleged to be over the years. To my knowledge, Rob, what do you want to say about that?
Well, you know, it's hard to say the provenance of this letter just kind of showed up. Nobody really knew where it came from. That myth is dispelled here as it says this letter showed up in our inter-office mail system at, you know, the Hunt headquarters after the assassination. And that in and of itself wasn't peculiar. The 60s were more of an innocent age, and people will find the stories in this book of getting on an airplane with a briefcase full of money or using an airline ticket in someone else's name to be altogether unbelievable. In reality, the idea of security was nothing even close to what it is today. By the same token, people would often drop off an envelope at the front desk of Hunt Oil, and it would get put into the mail system for delivery to the addressee. That is exactly how the Dear Mr. Hunt letter came in, and since it did, in fact, involve Mr. Hunt, and did, in fact, suggest a meeting with Oswald, we elected in turn to turn it over to the FBI, and we never saw it again. In private, Mr. Hunt did raise a question as to whether Lee Harvey Oswald could have been a lifeline listener, something that I think might have been a concern for him. He says the letter has become legendary over the years. Some say it was from an anonymous source, or from Mexico, or from this person or that, and it has been said that it was definitely written by Oswald because on one particular curlicue on a letter, or that it couldn't have been written by Oswald because of another particular curlicue on another letter. Personally, I have no idea whether it was written by Oswald or not. I only know that it showed up in our office, and we gave it to the FBI.
Okay. Now, what that shows you, first of all, is that a lot of things happened after the assassination where people tried to draw a lot of lines. Like I've stated on this show, Oswald was cited in, like, I don't know, 23 different cities, I think the FBI had down at one point. You know, and all kinds of things after his death, by the way. But after the assassination, this letter shows up, which is almost meaningless. Now, is it possible that it was entered into the, you know, internal mailing system by a prankster, by somebody who was looking to get back at Hunt, who didn't like his radio broadcasts, or did it indeed come from Oswald? There's all sorts of possibilities there, but as he said, this is where the thing kind of comes from. He doesn't know who originated it. He's not a guy who studied it or is an authority on the providence of said piece of writing. So he just basically says what he knows about it here. It sounds to me like a fairly honest book, but I guess there's some addendums to this story. Anything else you want to add here, Rob?
Just with the JFK, to tie that up, you know, before we talk about it, any of these other guys, he says that H.L. Hunt met with Marina Oswald on a Saturday morning in 1963, a short time after the Kennedy assassination, and that she came into the Hunt Oil offices at approximately 7 a.m., and Currington was told to clear out everybody out of the lobby and everybody off his floor and keep people out of the building. So Mr. Hunt showed up at 8:30 a.m. and that soon a woman would come into the lobby. I was not to speak with her or even acknowledge your presence with that. He turned and walked to the elevator and took it upstairs. A bit later, a woman did, in fact, walk into the building. She was alone and wearing a modest dress. I recognized her immediately as Marina Oswald, the widow of Lee Harvey Oswald. At that time, her picture was all over the media, newspapers, magazines, and television, and because of recent events, she was a very recognizable person. There's just no question that it wasn't her. He says, we didn't speak or even glance at each other. She ignored me and walked directly to the elevator, pushed the button, and disappeared inside. I did not see what destination her floor was. And that she spent approximately an hour upstairs and then came out and left. And basically, Hunt had never done that before. He had never ordered the office, the building cleared of people, nor did he ever do it again while I worked for him. At the time, H.O. Hunt's political views were well known. The Hunt name had spread throughout the world, and many fingers were being pointed at H.O. Hunt involving the death of John Kennedy. He basically says she denied meeting with Mr. Hunt in a later interview. And that he thinks that H.L. Hunt felt sorry for the woman and possibly gave her some money.
Well, you know what? That sounds like a fairly realistic and a reasonable account of what may have happened, according to a witness testifying about what they saw, in written form. Sounds pretty good, Rob. Actually, not a bad book. I had bad feelings when you brought it up. Sounds like a pretty interesting book. However, Carmine says he has some other information. So I'd like to hear about that.
I think Rob, too, can help us figure this one out because he has the modern version of what's going on. So this is the older one. So while Rob was talking about it, I figured, what the hell, I'll just, check out, see if anything pops up. And just so happens that Harold Weisberg collected an Inquirer article that he put into the Weisberg archives, over at Hood University. And I sent you guys a copy via the Skype. It says JFK assassins got money from Kennedy hating. So it seems like the story was different back when it first appeared. Now he's sort of like, as Rob said, he's trying to walk it back a little, like, Hunt didn't mean to. Maybe it was the radio. And this one, Hunt's definitely part of it.
Well, but see, in fairness, again, though, it's the National Enquirer. All right, so.
Exactly. Which Judy has appeared in, which Files has appeared in. It seems that almost every bad myth that comes along does their stint at the Inquirer.
Well, they not only do their stint, but they get recycled every couple of years, and you see brand new information, and it's the same thing they published back in the 80s. Just, they figure most of those readers have died off now. So
yeah, there are definitely some similar. I mean, like, of course, it's the John Currington guy that Rob was talking about. And he says, he was a close assistant of Hunt. And he said there was an amazing group of political parasites drawn to Hunt because of his radical right-wing views. Members of right-wing groups like the John Birch Society, Liberty Lobby, and KKK in New York, and Washington, and Dallas, and other places. But here's, I think, what might be the big difference. I don't know if this is in the new books, or Rob can tell me if it is. Did Hunt give packets of $40,000 to various people, various right-wing radicals outside the Hunt organization, because that's what he's saying he did in this, is that he was just handing out big bunches of money that couldn't be traced. And in this, Hunt actually has...
Yeah. He does mention it.
Yeah.
And in the RFK section of this book, he mentions a trip made to California 2 weeks before RFK was shot, where they stayed at the Ambassador Hotel. And he said Currington says that he was told to have somebody deliver $40,000 to somebody in California for whatever purpose. Currington said he didn't take it himself, that he was tasked with finding somebody to take it to somebody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, and he definitely mentions the $40,000.
Okay, so he also says in this earlier version that I was convinced. Okay, so does he have? Because the letter is mentioned, but once again, there's no provenance to it. It's just it came from somewhere. Believed it. It says believing that they were acting on Hunt's veiled. Because see, in this older version, it seems like Hunt is acting as a conspirator. he's not kind of, you know, back walking it back a little bit like he is more in the modern version. Because Hunt actually meets with Oswald, according to this. Does he meet with him in the later book?
No.
Yeah, he meets with Oswald, and he says, you know, via the letter, they say, or whatever, they say that, and Currington actually says that he knew Oswald was a parasite, and like you said, the thing with Ruby, they meet with Ruby. Yeah. What is it? It says, let me get to the part, Currington. The day after Oswald is arrested, I called urgently to Hunt's office. Hunt told me he wanted to find out what security measures surrounded Oswald at the Dallas Police Headquarters in City Jail. So he was basically, he's attributing that he set Oswald up to get killed with Ruby.
Right.
Does he say that in a new one?
He mentioned some talk with Joseph Civello.
Uh-huh.
Who was, you know, in Mafia in Dallas at the time. Yep.
Yeah, one of the big guys.
And there's something like that mentioned, yeah.
Okay,
Well, again, this is the National Enquirer, and I actually found a link to which I'm going to provide to the listeners in the live chat room, and I'll also attach to the podcast, which is alleged to be a full text of an interview from Currington John W. regarding these topics at archives.org, I think. Yeah, archive.org. And, you know, look, I leave it as an open question. But the description of the book that Rob has given here and the interesting stuff which has been debunked in that book, you know, leads me to believe that maybe the Enquirer ran with parts of a story and possibly embellished it. I mean, I know it's a crazy concept that the Enquirer might embellish a story, but I've actually known people that have had articles written about them in the Enquirer. And,
Oh yeah. When they're the target, I totally understand that embellishment's going to occur and they're probably going to lie about them. I just think when they go to the Enquirer or when it's a beneficial article, there's definitely questions. And it's not like, I'm not saying that there aren't things in the modern, but once again, there are positive things, but I still don't think that H.L. Hunt had anything to do with JFK's death.
Well, see, I know, and I understand, but like one of the guys that I knew that was in one of those gangster editions of the Enquirer in the early 2000s was a brother, actually. They call him brother Frank, and Frank Minucci, who was in the Enquirer article, they categorize him as a soldier for the Lucchese crime family and the president of the Hell's Angels. The truth is that he was the president of the Nomads, which is a sect of the Hell's Angels, and that he had never been a full fledged gangster in the Lucchese crime family. However, he was an associate. But the Enquirer embellished various parts of his story, and that was a personal friend of mine that that I knew quite well. Okay, and you know, and I've got other examples too. But who wants to go through all of it? What I'm saying is that, you know, taking a look at an Enquirer article might give you a point of interest, but you know, to think that reliable journalism is being done there is yet another kettle of fish altogether, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I don't think it's reliable journalism. I think it shows that he wanted to get the story out. And it was a long time ago before this version came out.
Oh, yeah. And back when this was being done, you know, the payment, they paid the subjects of stories, you know,
still
a couple
do,
hundred bucks.
As and, you know, with the Trump thing.
And they still do. I've been told it's up to $500 if you have a nothing story, pretty much, that they're willing to print. And it goes on more than one page. You get $500. You know, there it goes. At one time, I know it was 200. But, and it doesn't matter if you're, again, the guy who's being written about or you're the source or whatever, they pay for their articles. And look, fair enough. But, to expect, you know, the facts to be straight in that earlier version, it could be that he gave them the very same version that Rob is reading. And, it might not point to an inconsistency in his story. It could be an inconsistency in the Enquirer's writing. I'm just trying to be fair to Currington here, you know.
And that's fine. But I also think that, I think the inconsistency isn't with Currington or any of this. I think it's with H.L. Hunt. I think that's the big inconsistency, is that people have been pushing the oil man thing for decades, and there really is no substantial evidence for it.
Well, right. But again, although it's interesting that, and by the way, there's more to that book because, like you said, it ties to Bobby Kennedy's assassination, King's assassination, Hoffa. I mean, there's a lot more going on.
Do you think, see that, I think too, though, that that's one of the things that makes me doubt it is that really this one guy did all those? Really?
Well, no, but the thing is,
it's just so complex for one. Now we're going to add other ones.
But to say that there wasn't a general public sentiment that was being created, like if it really boiled down to H.L. Hunt's media influence and money being added into certain causes, he could believe himself to be a direct contributor to all of those coming from one particular side of the equation. So that is not unreasonable as long as they're not drawing direct lines to paying assassins and creating groups of people that are out there to murder people directly. Actually, it sounds a lot more plausible because there isn't that bit of juicy detail in it. Sounds like anyway, Rob. I mean, you read the book. Tell us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all know and heard the stories of J. Edgar Hoover being tight with H.L. Hunt. Now, I'm going to drop some juicy bits on you because there is some high specifics concerning the Martin Luther King thing.
Well, look, before we go there, we're really late on the break, so I want to take my break. And then, you know, we'll reorganize our thoughts a little bit and come back and drop some more juicy bits and maybe in rapid-fire fashion get through a couple of other quick myths here because we're going to run right out of time. Yeah.
Exactly. This one, you know, we always get engaged on the weirdo stuff that Rob brings.
Well, I love it. I am still in awe of the Scientology one. That is the best ever.
Yeah. The Hoover one, not the Hoover, but Hubbard one is going to be one to top. But, and honestly, I can just do I'll throw the legal in a future one, and we can just do the McVicker, the new research stuff as my myth. And then we can go back into this one, come back.
Sounds good. So we're taking the break late, but this is the JFK Myths series that we're continuing. Rob Clark from the Lone Gunman podcast, and, of course, Carmine Sabastano, the author of Two Princes and a King, is with me. TPAAK, TPAAK.com. Neapolis Media Group here in full effect. And thankfully, we got Rob to show up during the summer because, as I said, it's difficult to get people here in the summertime. And glad to have Rob Clark along with us. So we'll get through this break really fast and come right back at you so we can finish out this, the 14th episode of Myths. JFK Myths, Assassination Myths, here on the Ocelli Effect. Stick around.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Time to open your eyes and read behind the lies at Ocelli.com. Bitches.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck Ocelli. Second hour of the Ocelli Effect beginning awfully late here at Ocelli.com, but do appreciate you for tuning in. We are doing the JFK Myths number 14 with Carmine Savastano, the author of Two Princes and a King. TPAK, TPAAK.com is his website. And the host of the Lone Gunman podcast, Rob Clark, who, although he's on hiatus, listen, all of the old episodes of the Lone Gunman are out there, and I advise you guys go get them from wherever you can. You still got the website?
Nope. Just Google it. You'll find it.
Google it and you'll find it. I'll yes. tell you, man. But listen, when you do get back to running, maybe we could come up with a deal where I can run the Lone Gunman on my stream. Okay? Because I got a 24/7 stream, and I would love to make it one of the shows that we just run every time you do one.
Yeah, that's cool with me.
Well, it sounds like we might have a plan in the making, but let's not bore you guys listening with that. You said you had some juicy stuff to drop in before we went to break, and I invite you to drop it on in, Rob.
All right. You know, we talked about the clear, level-headed logicness of you know, H.L. Hunt and this book and his effect possibly on the JFK assassination. And then I got to the MLK part of this book, and John Carrington says, at Mr. Hunt's instruction, I traveled to call on Percy Forman. Now, Percy Forman was the first lawyer that James Earl Ray had, okay, after they caught him, you know, in London. And he says he traveled to Percy Forman with a briefcase and laid it on the desk in front of him and said, I have 125,000 reasons why James Earl Ray should plead guilty to killing Martin Luther King.
Oh,
he said, Forman looked at me and said, well, you just leave them with me and I'll have a look at them. He says, I left $125,000, which would just be under $1 million in today's money. And sure enough, James Earl Ray entered a guilty plea. 3 days later, Ray asked the judge for a change of plea, a new attorney, and a trial by jury, and his request was denied. When Los Angeles Times newspaper eulogized Percy Forman, on his death in August 26, 1988. It included the notation that he persuaded James Earl Ray to plead guilty to the 1968 slaying of King, the Nobel Prize-winning civil rights leader, in exchange for a 99-year sentence. Now, he says his final thoughts on the MLK thing was, I paid $125,000 from H.L. Hunt to Percy Forman to get James Earl Ray to confess to the killing of Martin Luther King. Although that is exactly what happened, Ray soon recanted his confession, and to this day, the King family believes that he was innocent of the murder. And then he asked a hypothetical question, you know, why was it so important for Mr. Hunt to have a confession from Ray? He again attributed it to him being scared that somehow Ray could have possibly been influenced by his sphere of influence, you know, and the things that he was saying on his show. I mean, he even went so far as to go back and have tapes destroyed of previous shows that he did about Martin Luther King, you know, and just have them destroyed, you know, burn up, ripped up, and basically gone forever, you know, the original tapes. You know, I touched on the thing about Bobby Kennedy and the $40,000 and they staying at the ambassador 2 weeks before he was killed. You know, it's just things like that. I mean, I was expecting this book to be some kind of crazy off the wall, you know, usual nut job thing. But I was pleasantly surprised, I should say, what it included. You know, there's other than that, you know, of course, there's no proof of it. You know,
well, yeah.
James Earl Ray did confess initially to killing King, and he did recant his confession. You know, but of course, we have no proof that it was because John Carrington paid him $125,000 to his lawyer, you know, and that it came from H.L. Hunt. You know, that's just whatever assertion he's making in the book. But other than that, I think, you know, all in all, it's a pretty solid book. And I was ready, you know, when I agreed to come on the Myth Show, I was thinking, oh, man, I got a good one. I'm sure this book is full of crap. And, you know, we're going to have a gay old time, you know, talking about all this stuff. But I must say, you know, while it, you know, didn't come across as what I thought it was going to be, it's a decent book. It dispels some myths, you know, and it creates some others. But, you know, that's pretty standard fare with most assassination-related books these days, you know?
Well, I don't understand the logic behind buying James Earl Ray's confession here exactly, unless the suggestion is it's to cover up who the real culprits were. I don't know. Look, to me, it sounds like it's not a very exciting piece. I mean, it might be interesting though, and doesn't necessarily do a whirlwind of damage like most of the things we wind up talking about on these shows. So, it's interesting though. I appreciate it, Rob. Kind of tame for you bringing this one forward, but
I thought I had a juicy one, man. I thought it was going to be a good one, you know. But hey, you know, look, I must say they can't all be, you know, winners.
Well, exactly. not every diamond is named Hope. Okay, so
that's right.
Well, and yeah, and you can only have, you know, so many number one freaks of the week until eventually you're going to find one that, you know, just a little bit weird, not totally.
Yeah, I mean,
crazy.
it's an aspect of the assassination that nobody really talks about much, and that's, you know, part of the extreme right wing that was going on in Dallas at that time.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, no, I was just saying, it's just part of the political atmosphere of the time.
Yeah, yeah, and listen, you know, few things are,
wingers were. Yeah.
Few things are going to match up to the homosexual thrill kill thing that somebody mentioned in the chat room. You know,
there's a future one.
Yeah, we're definitely going to have to tackle that one in Myths 15 after the summer's over. So
there is a book out there, and it's either called that or it addresses that. I've seen it.
Yeah, well, it's been a speculation over the years because in the, again, you know, in the universe of Lee Harvey Oswald, there are an awful lot of gay men, you know, that keep coming up in various places. So, you know, there's a reason for that.
He's even been accused of being a little swishy himself, you know, and Ruby too. So,
well, yeah. And some of the things, you know, listen, there's a lot to speculate on there, but that'll be in Myths 15. So we'll leave it at that. Carmine, I've been holding you back this entire time.
It's okay. Can I throw in one last thing about the thing? I want to say thank you to you and Rob, because you guys do actually, though I have read a handful of books, the ones usually that, like, you know, Judy's that I'm debunking. You guys do, as where I attempt to do the lion's share of document research for as many of us as I can, you guys do the book research. So I really appreciate that, because God knows I don't have time to go through all the documents and try to go through all the books too, which, you know, you've both reported to me largely. You know, there are the good ones that are out there, and there are the extremely bad ones, but most of them are 70% the exact same thing.
Well, you'd much rather do monotonous research as opposed to torturing yourself intellectually, which, you know, Rob and I are a little bit sadist in this way. We like going and saying, oh, this has got to be ridiculous. Let me read this. This is what you see, he agreed with me. This is one of the things we do every now and then. Yes, we look for good books, but we also go, oh, this has got to be truly, absolutely insane. Let's see if this has even got full sentences in it. Oh, it is. Yeah. Great. I can read this and hurt my brain. All right. So this is what we do. Carmine, I ask for your contribution, and I'll try and let Rob comment on it, because now we're almost halfway through the second hour, and I want to make sure we cover a few more things before we're done tonight.
Okay. Well, this is a recent thing that I talked about a little bit, or said I was going to be doing a new article last show that we did together. And the name of the related article, it'll be listed in the with links to all the evidence, and it's called Note the Chain. And basically, those involved in the research of documents in the Kennedy case no doubt often come across wholly deceptive and mythical claims started by officials or members of the public that have evolved over time into what some consider reliable but lacking all verifiable evidence. The problem would seem to be a stark belief in the proffered ideas of each side by their advocates. What actually proves to be the facts do not often sway those wholly committed to a theory of Oswald's guilt or innocence, because facts are unyielding to desire. And the silencing of valid questions is not as easy as silencing a detractor. A sure way to combat any unfounded belief that relies on just a portion of the facts is by subjecting them to serious criticism in comparison to the evidence. Perhaps the most damaging claim a government official can make is verifiably false ones. Those indeed are the motivation, and the motivation for deception can be debated and might rely on multiple factors, some of which, like national security, can be justified in proper circumstances. Several official excuses, however, cannot be so easily defended. Hence the need to lie. When enough official deceptions can be documented relating to a subject, it reasonably causes advocates of to wish greater declassification, and critics in the public to mistrust future claims, and demands for greater transparency usually follow, which is counter to the entire reasoning behind official deception. Perhaps officials would face less public outcry if they reserved deception for only justified instances. One more recent example of some officials being mistaken and others lying are the claims of Lee Harvey Oswald not encountering repeated CIA-connected people on his first day in Moscow, seeking to distance itself from Oswald for whatever reason. The agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, and several people connected to them repeatedly denied multiple official investigations information. Among directly those affecting Oswald's actions in the U.S., or in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, was official John McVicker. Concerning his background, I prior wrote a related article that states, John Anthony McVicker was born in Manhattan, New York, May 22, 1924. He was educated at St. Mark's High School, Georgetown University, and served during World War II in the United States Navy. Subsequently, McVicker attended the U.S. Foreign Service School in 1948, and both he and Richard Schneider, who was the second secretary at the Moscow Embassy at the same time, were on the same waiting list for employment with the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service. The CIA later recruits Snyder in the Foreign Service using State Department cover, and McVicker testifies he too gained State Department employment, but without intelligence connections. So before I go on, I know both of you gentlemen are familiar with McVicker, and what have you heard over the years about him?
I'll let Rob field that first.
Not much, honestly.
Well, look, he comes up during the, you know, the various stories of interaction and officials that interacted with Oswald and with the Oswald case one way or another. But he really has never been a featured player. He's just one of these guys that happened to be there, right? So
yep. Yeah, I've always heard more about Snyder than McVicker. But
yeah, I was just going to say Snyder is usually the guy that you hear from, yeah.
So, and I agree with you, Snyder was the second counsel, so he was definitely the ranking person. McVicker is often referred to as his assistant.
Right.
And, yeah, largely he's overlooked, I think, because of the role he plays. He doesn't Snyder seems to be, you know, and even in McVicker's statement, you know, we'll discuss a little bit, Snyder seems to be actively pushing Oswald to complete his defection, but at the same time, he denies Oswald revoking his citizenship, tells him to go think about it, and then holds on to the passport for years.
Right.
Which is the only reason why Oswald is allowed to immigrate back with Marina.
Well, Schneider, where I describe him just throwing it in the drawer, and that's literally what he did. He just kind of threw it in his desk drawer, the passport and all that, right?
Yep, where it sat for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
He took no action, even though Oswald had, you know, as we'll go into it, gave him several reasons why he should have done something.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so, yeah, and McVicker pretty much stays in the background, which is, I think, where he intended to be. Because some of the research that I've been doing lately, despite McVicker's claims to later investigations, both the President's Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, he did, in fact, have connections to the Central Intelligence Agency that precede and follow his interactions with Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina.
Yeah, see, who didn't in the embassy there? I mean, this is the bigger question to my mind. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's who manned most of the international, you know, embassies. Was it's, you know, chock full of CIA people. And even the foreign governments' embassies, like in Mexico City, they're chock full of KGB agents.
Well, but that's
just the way spycraft worked back then.
Well, and who are you gonna put in, you know, your number one adversary's, you know, country? Yeah. Who are you gonna insert?
Intelligence gatherers.
You want intelligence gatherers, right, Carmine?
Yeah, especially in Moscow, because Moscow was known as the denied area, which is an area that is very difficult to get any sort of intelligence operations undergoing. It actually had its own thing called Moscow rules where, you know, you had to use very specialized ways so you weren't caught, because that's all they were doing. I mean, they found, I think when they rebuilt the embassy at one point and then put in a secure area in the top, because they found in the original embassy there were bugs everywhere, in every floor, in every office.
All the workers were probably being watched like hawks, you know.
And that's another thing, too, is they had to worry about they actually a lot of times had to import workers in, because all the Russian ones would, of course, be working for the KGB or the NKVD.
Right. So what are you going to do? You know,
standard fare.
Right. I mean, and this would have been the case whether Oswald was, pre-planned or not. I mean, he was going to encounter CIA people at the American embassy. It's just that simple.
Exactly.
And he did, despite the denials, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's the big, I think, that makes this a different issue. It was, and, you know, I'll go into the specifics, but it would have been normal for him to encounter a CIA person, no big deal. But it's what these CIA people did, and it's when that interaction went beyond the embassy that I think is very notable in Oswald's case.
Fair enough. Yeah.
McVicker, years before his application to the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service, was the longtime friend of a CIA agent using the cryptonym Unmoved in 1949. This is from one agency document. Hmm. The file concerning McVicker stated that Unmoved suggested that McVicker be employed by the agency in 1949 because, quote, the subject appears to be the type of individual which might be ideally suited to fulfill certain valuable operational assignments, such as spotter for other high-level potential agents. This was due to McVicker's seeming ability to befriend nearly anyone in several countries across the world via his business dealings. Quite interesting is a line that states, quote, it is our thought that perhaps subject's unusual personality and in the cover job he now occupies could be exploited to advantage by this station and the organization as a whole. Cover job he now occupies.
There you go.
Now, I'm not saying that in itself, we have much more evidence to add to that. But that, I think, is an inference that perhaps he was undertaking something at the time, even as a contact. I'm not saying he was a spy or anything, but he was filtering information back to Unmoved.
Right. So, anyway, you know, it's just the constant denials are the fun part of this, really. You know, Patricia Johnson, for instance.
Yeah. Priscilla, don't do that to me. You're going to make me say Patricia again.
Oh, I did it. I did it again, didn't I? Priscilla Johnson. I'm sorry. I keep doing that.
Whenever I type it out and I write Patricia, I'm like, damn it, Chuck.
It's my fault. Priscilla Johnson. Priscilla McMillan Johnson or Johnson McMillan. Who cares? Point is, you know, I had nothing to do with the CIA. Yeah, you did. And, you know, it's just, what are you going to do with this stuff? I mean, it's funny because some of the people that were thought to be outlandishly speculating for the longest time turn out to be accurately assessing these individuals as connected to the agency, which is funny stuff to me. Meanwhile, somebody entered into the chat room about this this character that that Rob was talking about. Let me roll this back a second. There's apparently something in Weisberg's archives also talking about Currington and Rothamel were selling info to Weisberg on H.L. Hunt, I guess, as a scam.
That's the other guy. It was Rothamel.
Yeah.
Who allegedly tried to buy a copy of this Pruder film.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was what was interesting to me is that he's a guy whose name comes up in a lot of people's writings in legitimate fashion and illegitimate fashion. Yes. You know, Joan Mellon talks about him a bit. and explains, you know, what his roles were in certain instances. But a lot of people have also, because of the Zapruder film thing, you know, because Hunt and Bird, they had trophies, right? And they would all sit around, get drunk, and watch the Zapruder film while they had the window from the sixth floor depository, sitting in their living room, allegedly. All this kind of stuff goes around, too. But, you know, the reality is that certainly there must have been some influence that came from there. And I don't doubt that a lot of people tried to sell information to Weisberg over the years. And the mention of Harrison Livingstone in that Chatter's sentence, my God, man, that guy's a story in and of himself. So there's a guy I knew. Thankfully, he's dead. Okay, Carmine.
Yeah, I'd say that. Oh, I just want to say one thing. It doesn't matter in this case or any case. If you buy your information, it's probably not valid information.
Oh, there you go.
If someone really wants to help, if someone really wants to change this and like make some historical definitive claims, you shouldn't buy anything. It should just be given freely to the public. They can do a book tour and make money all sorts of other ways. They don't have to charge you for the evidence.
Well, right, but you know, Weisberg had become approached by so many different people over the years offering inside information, offering documents, offering you name it. You know, Weisberg, for his many mistakes, did a huge amount of work collecting just information in general over the years, and you could take a look at it at, I think it's Hood College has it, and some of it's accessible online now, I believe.
Yeah, there's a lot of it I've gone through that, and there is some really good stuff in there, and then there's some other stuff, you know, but you're going to get that pretty much wherever you look.
Well, right, but given that, you know, the time period in which Weisberg was working, I mean, this was a guy who was a true believer, too, who was, you know, literally physically printing books out of his house and putting them together by hand before he shipped them out to you. I mean, this dude was in it for, I do believe, absolutely legitimate reasons. He made his mistakes as well, but a lot of the earlier researchers did.
Well, we all are going to at some point.
And you know, we all do.
We're not going to be right about everything.
And
yeah.
We all do.
Yeah, it's the people who won't change after they know they made the mistake that are usually the problem.
Right.
Well said. Yeah.
And you know, go ahead, Carmine.
Do you want me to continue? Or?
Well, yeah, we've got a little more show left. So, I mean, let's squeeze in what we can. We started a little bit late and took a break.
Well, I have
late,
some more for McVicker.
Go ahead.
Okay, so the KGB targeted McVicker in 1961 with a honey trap, using a foreign woman operating under an alias hoping to blackmail him.
Russian name Marina?
it wasn't.
Okay.
I think it was. I can't remember. No, it's okay. It's like Natasha or something like that. But Russian intelligence spending additional resources on McVicker and believing he was connected to American intelligence in 1961 affirms his existing, his relationship with the CIA is a reasonable suspicion. In 1966, years after McVicker's encounter with Oswald, he is granted top secret security approval for liaison contact with the CIA. So that pretty much blows it out of the water. In 1968, the CIA learns Eastern German intelligence identified both Snyder and McVicker as being operatives of the CIA. Unlike many documents, when accusations that are false are denied, usually with other evidence to support the CIA's contention internally, these documents are matter of fact, and no denial is contained in either. Evidence would utterly refute the claims on the record by McVicker and multiple officials that he did not possess any intelligence connections. It transforms his claims to deception, one seemingly designed to distance those with CIA connections from the question of whether Lee Harvey Oswald was used in some capacity within Russia. Conversely, it strengthens the doubts about official integrity and honesty regarding these and other issues. These denials cement the reasonable doubts that Oswald alone conceived of his every deed. The proposition is, by officials, that he was the proposition that he was a possible witting or unwitting dupe steered by someone years prior in the Soviet Union for possibly unconnected operational reasons to incite the KGB is reasonable based on the current evidence. This, too, would increase the possibilities as a known quantity he could later be used by someone else within or without the intelligence community. Yet CIA officials attempt to deny knowledge of him until long after his defection that we can firmly establish based on McVicker and Snyder transmitting copies of the Oswald interaction to the State Department and the agency based on the official account. So that's just absolutely not true. I know that's been stated by people like Bill Simbich and John Newman and, you know, other people who have done some great work before. But, I mean, that is the case. They've been right. They're right. The CIA knew October 31st, 1959, or whenever, you know, maybe the next day when McVicker sent out the telegram that went to all the different agencies. They knew what he was doing.
Right.
They knew he arrived in Moscow. They knew what was going on. So, with each additional intelligence connection, the agency's denial of any important knowledge of Oswald and that he had no connection to those to any of those surrounding him grows more unlikely and does not enjoy the support of definitive evidence. The many problems and stark contrasts the record contains in comparison to the agency's claims is notable. Consider the original story offered by officials that it was inconceivable the CIA would lie to investigators and would use someone like Oswald. As time passed, and the sterling gleam of official pronouncements fades, Richard Snyder is identified as being a CIA employee. While Snyder was the primary official dealing with Oswald, it is not uncommon for the agency or former agency employees to use embassy cover. Critics believed this is just one person. Officials likely offered it was an aberration, and conspiracy advocates were just too concerned with the case, reading into a single connection being important. Several years later, under a pseudonym, a CIA Soviet Russia division officer, Jacques Richardson, considers using Oswald on paper as he was simultaneously running a separate defector who also married a Russian woman and immigrated to a Western country, just like Oswald did. In fact, Richardson noticed a dozen cases of such instances that bothered him and others in the agency. He was concerned it was a series of honey traps set up by Russian intelligence to have agents in place within Western nations. A decade later, we now have established that the reporter and author Priscilla Johnson McMillan was also a CIA contact, and used by them before and after Oswald's interactions with her at the behest of John McVicker. Now the evidence verifies that McVicker, too, had connections to the CIA long before his contact with Oswald and was officially used by them years later. Thus, every person Lee Harvey Oswald had extended interactions with October 31st, 1959 at the Moscow embassy and within his room at the Hotel Metropole on the first day in Russia have established CIA connections.
Well, wait a minute now. There may have actually been a bellhop or something that was connected to...
There might be another guy, yeah, that we don't know about. But I'm saying no matter what, everybody he talked to at length that day was connected to the CIA.
You're right. Okay.
Most of them lied about it.
Fair enough. Your thoughts, Rob?
Well, I mean, it's undeniable. I mean, and it makes sense. It's logical that we would have in place in our embassies, especially in Russia, CIA undercover, you know, intelligence assets. I mean, it just makes sense. And there's, I mean, and like Carmine said, I mean, they admitted it. And, you know, of course they're going to deny it, deny it, deny it, deny. But when we have the official documents to say, hey, these guys were, well, there you go. And we know now that Priscilla Johnson was too. And there's no denying it. And whether or not that, you know, puts Oswald either unknowingly in the middle of something that was going on over there or knowingly that was going on over there, you know, we still don't know 100% either way yet. But it's interesting. It's something to think about. For sure.
And you certainly would want to make sure you had those sorts of assets in place if you're going to run a false defector program, which I am satisfied that they were running. As for whether Oswald was part of it, it does seem likely that he was part of it, but not an absolute fact. You know, but again, useful idiots, right? I love that phrase, which Larry Hancock points to as literally in the Russian literature regarding KGB recruitment. Oswald could have easily just been a useful idiot, or he could have been a knowing pawn in the game. But either way, he's certainly on the board. And that's all there is to it. I mean, you can't make a claim otherwise, I think, Rob. In the last 10 minutes here, Carmine, is there something that you would like to get to or something Rob would like to throw in before we're done here tonight?
Well, if you don't mind, I got a little bit more McVicker, and then, yeah, whatever you guys want to talk about is fine.
Well, what do you think, Rob? Should we go further into McVicker, or do we need to go somewhere else?
No, rock on.
All right.
Okay.
Rock on. Nice.
Well, indeed, over the course of years, I want to give – I just want to counter an excuse that's going to probably be offered by some of the people who don't want to believe that McVicker, like Johnson and Snyder, were all connected to the CIA. So – over the course of years, an official proponent might claim, based on the circles Oswald traveled in, he might stumble across an intelligence operation or a few agents, which is true. But the Moscow embassy events occurred in roughly 24 hours. It is highly improbable, based on the evidence, that all these occurrences are by chance, and that the CIA could be ignorant of Oswald until much later is claimed. How many of their contacts, former employees, and sources of information would Oswald have needed to speak to in that short amount of time to gain interest? I would imagine that three in one day might register some notice. Another factor of interest is that the steering I referred to earlier, if all the interactions had occurred in the embassy, officials could at least claim it was during the course of regular business. They could purport those who believed Oswald was overly influenced by people in the embassy were mistaken. Yet we have the testimony of McVicker that second counsel Richard Snyder did seem to push Oswald to defect and remain in Russia. We also have McVicker, out of asserted concern, suggest a local hotel to Oswald and then dispatch Priscilla McMillan to interview him outside the embassy. We are no longer in the territory of simple explanations. A single encounter that can be attributed to Oswald's self-determined appearance is not what happened. The extent of the contact now reasonably extends into possible steering, with the appearance of McMillan at Oswald's hotel room. The most central reason for intelligence organizations to exist is to gather intelligence on possibly useful targets or agents, commonly known as spotting. McMillan then conducts a lengthy hours-long session with Oswald that would later help support the official story. The next evening, McVicker and McMillan dine together, and she reports her encounter with Oswald akin to an intelligence debriefing she received from CIA agent Gary Coit during the 1960s. Snyder and McVicker would subsequently aid Lee and Morena in traveling to the United States, despite all the information they had on Oswald being a defector who allegedly stated he would tell military secrets to the Soviets and then attempted to renounce his citizenship. McMillan and McVicker would each lie repeatedly to the public and multiple investigations about their intelligence ties. None of this was mentioned to the President's Commission or to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Officials, reporters, and witnesses, no matter if they are critics or advocates of conspiracy, can all lie. And these did about essential facts that would not require legitimate concealment in a private official investigation.
And even as we speak today, McMillan is still, you know, dragged out of the, you know, out from under a rock every single time. They do a segment, it seems like, in a documentary related to the Kennedy assassination. Oh, well, I knew both Jack Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald personally, and they never mention that she was a asset.
Oh, you know? There's some people that when I mention it in groups online and various social media get upset and say I'm lying. And then I'll give them the evidence, and they say they don't believe it. Well, then, you know what? You're just as bad as the worst of the fringe conspiracy people. You're just a conspiracist for the officials.
Yeah, right. I
mean, you believed the official conspiracy.
Don't you find that remarkable, Rob, that every single time you see one of these documentaries, because I know you're, again, probably a media consumer much like me, you know, you go, all right, I know this is going to be another ridiculous, you know, are they going to blame it on Russia? Are they going to try and follow through a bunch of, you know, crappy conspiracy theories and debunk them? Or are they just going to do a completely sanitized version of the assassination? Let's watch. You do this, right, when you see a new film or a new TV segment pop up somewhere. And inevitably, you're confronted with, you know, Priscilla McMillan, who shows up and it's like, and here's the woman who knew both Oswald and Kennedy, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, when you think about it, you know, when this just bolsters the claim that the CIA was watching this guy. I mean, if not before October 31st, 1959, then certainly almost every day afterwards, even after he comes back to the United States, you've got the CIA assets sniffing around him in Dallas, in New Orleans. You know, I mean, the guy was even at, you know,
Atsugi Air Base, which is one of the CIA, you know, spy schools, or not spy schools, but, you know, one of the base, you know, where they were doing secret stuff out of.
Yeah, it was the base for the U-2 flights, which at that time was a, you know, not a well-known thing, quite honestly. Still had its secretive nature to it and all that. There is the concept that, you know, maybe Oswald was willing to share what he knew about U-2 flights, and maybe there wasn't a lot to it and all that. But certainly he was somebody who had a clearance at one point. He was somebody who had some information, and he maybe wanted to trade on it. Now, whether he was influenced to do that by somebody else or he came up with it on his own is still an open question in my mind. But the more you look at it, you can't say that the CIA or any of the intelligence agencies in the United States wasn't fully aware of and able to influence the situations in which Oswald was involved in between 1959, certainly, and the assassination. So for 4 years, this guy was certainly on the menu. And to claim otherwise is absolutely ludicrous, I think. Anyways.
Yeah, and not just him, you know. I'm sure they had an interest in Marina as well.
Definitely.
For the exact reasons that you say, you know, as being one of these honeypots, sparrows, whatever you want to call them, you know, intelligence gatherers. And then lo and behold, she makes her way back to the United States. Now Russia has an asset for intelligence inside America. You know, they just did to us what we did to them.
Right.
You know, it's part of the spycraft thing. And to keep an eye on her or him or what they're doing makes perfect sense once they get back here.
Well, whether we're whether we are dangling him or they are inserting her, one way or another, this is just, you know, a minor story, really, in espionage, had it not been for Oswald's involvement in November 22nd, 1963. It would have just been one of many stories that probably nobody would have taken notice of. It was just part and parcel of what went on during the Cold War and the exchange of activities between the intelligence agencies of the time. And it's just that simple. You can look at it that way, or you can go deeper. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that's been developed by people like Simpich, like John Newman, like Carmine, that shows, guess what? There might be a whole lot more to it. So we're almost out of time, Carmine. Is there anything you want to kind of close out with here tonight?
Well, I just wanted to hopefully wrap it up, bring it back around to the end. The funny thing about me finding out about McVicker, I was happy to add him to the McMillan set. But that's just a personal thing. I was just happy that we got all three of them. So now there's really nobody that Oswald didn't interact with that had a connection. But the entire reason I went after McVicker, because I thought I had squeezed all the blood out of that stone when I found Johnson. McVicker only came up to me because I was reading an old ARB document. And the ARB, one of Gunn's questions that he never got an answer to, was McVicker, because he found out that they were changing 201 files, like we've just talked about before, and that the only reason we can figure out which ones they've changed and things that they've deleted are because of the errors in the record, the bookkeeping. So they found that they were doing that, and one of Gunn's questions was, is John McVicker a CIA contact or asset?
Mm.
So I was like, you know what? Let's see if he was. And then I started looking in the new documents, and I just happened to come across one.
So there it is. Look, again, no smoking gun in the new documents, but a few useful tidbits here and there to flesh out some of the characters that already existed. Rob Clark, the host of The Lone Gunman, on hiatus at the moment, and certainly I advise you guys to go look for wherever you can find The Lone Gunman podcasts. I know they're still available in the iTunes store and all that. So in a couple of them are anyway, and there's been a few other places I've seen it. Maybe Stitcher. YouTube. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you can find it anywhere at iTunes Store, Stitcher. It's on the Google Flow, so it pretty much shows up in any podcatcher if you search for it.
Nice. Okay.
For
and
sure.
Hopefully, we'll be able to start including new ones on the stream here. Because certainly I would love to make that part of what it is we play here on 24/7. So, you know, let's get that.
You allow
done.
That kind of language on your on your stream?
I'll not usually, but for you, I'll make an exception. I'll put it on the weekends.
Right. There you go. After 10.
There you go. So that's the way we'll do it. And yes, Rob is usually a little more loose with the language than I am, certainly, but, it's okay, man. The information is really interesting. He has people on that, that I don't, quite honestly. And, sometimes I can't get some of the same people Rob gets. So it's interesting to see what you focus on too. And it is done in the unique fashion. I mean, I really do appreciate your work, man. It's really great. So, certainly I advise people to check out the Lone Gunman podcast, when it comes to an interest in the JFK assassination and some of the other topics that are related to it. Certainly take a look at Rob Clark's work. And Carmine, you know, TPAAK, TPAAK.com is his website. There will be some links to his website in this podcast when it's presented. Probably in the morning I'll get it done, but when I put it out there, we'll have some links to some of Carmine's work, his website, all that. But I want to thank both of you guys for being on with me tonight, and we're just about done. Anything you want to say in closing, finally, Carmine?
Yeah, no, I hope everyone enjoyed it, and you know, we'll keep putting out Myths episodes. It was great to do a show with Rob. I'm looking forward to doing another one soon, and hope everybody has a good night.
Absolutely. And again, thanks, Rob. I do appreciate you being here. It's a rarity, man. And you got to come back for the next Myths episode, because we're going to get a panel together and really nail some stuff. So you got to dig up one of those crazy ones for us, though, okay?
I'll find you something, buddy. I'll find you something.
Sounds good to me. Anyway, you can't really beat QAnon being headed up by JFK Jr., tonight, anyway, who faked his own death and all that, but
you won this time.
I won this time. That's amazing, but I guarantee I won't next time. Anyway, Rob Clark, Carmine Savastano, this has been JFK Myths number 14. The Ocelli Effect is done, and I'll tell you this much, I am merely Ocelli. All of you who participate in this show, you are the effect. Have a good night.